From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Republican senators came out of a top-secret briefing room today to say that a supplemental FBI investigation into sexual misconduct accusations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh have produced no new corroborating evidence. A vote on beginning his confirmation can go ahead. Here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor this morning.
We have a chance to do good here. And to underscore the basic tenet of fairness in our country. So I filed cloture on the nomination yesterday evening, and I'll be proud to vote to advance this nomination tomorrow.
But Democrats are crying foul. Here's Ranking Judiciary Committee member Dianne Feinstein.
It looks to be a product of an incomplete investigation that was limited. Perhaps by the White House. I don't know.
Tim Mak covers national security and politics for NPR. Tim, we know you're watching undecided Republicans, Arizona Senator Jeff Flake and Maine Senator Susan Collins. Have they said anything?
Well, it's interesting. They are definitely going to have a very tense 24 hours as they decide whether or not to support Judge Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court. They're going to be sought after by pretty much everyone in the Capitol to try to sway their vote and by reporters trying to understand how they're going to vote. Right now, they haven't made a definitive declaration about which way they're going to go, but we'll be watching very closely as that process proceeds.
We're hearing the time slots for reading this single copy of this report in this top secret room that you've been staked out outside of for the morning. Those slots are filling up. Will everyone be able to read it before tomorrow and a vote?
I expect so. So there's a whole day to do so before a key procedural vote tomorrow. And what the Senate is doing is designating 1 hour for Republicans to review those documents and then followed by another hour for Democrats to review and alternating back and forth. So there are these rooms in the Capitol complex called sensitive compartmented information facilities. They're usually reserved for classified documents, intelligence briefings, that sort of thing. But today it's going to host these documents that make up the FBI background investigation into Brett Kavanaugh.
Talk about the sense of the investigation. It's, of course, falling along party lines, Republicans saying it was thorough, Democrats saying it wasn't, that it was limited. The White House has confirmed that 9 people were interviewed. We know the people that one of Brett Kavanaugh's accusers say were in the vicinity when that happened. But who else? Who was interviewed?
So NPR has confirmed 6 people who the FBI interviewed as part of its investigation. That includes Kavanaugh's high school friends, P.J. Smith, Mark Judge, who we've heard a lot about, Tim Gaudette, Chris Garrett, as well as Ford's friend Leland Kaiser, and a second Kavanaugh accuser, Deborah Ramirez. So as interesting as that might be, it's also interesting who wasn't interviewed. Ford, who's a professor in California, she was not interviewed by the FBI, and Kavanaugh has not been questioned either.
Yeah. Deborah Ramirez, the second accuser, told The New Yorker she feels like she's being silenced. The FBI denied her an interview, she says, for 5 days and didn't interview people she named as possible witnesses. And Kavanaugh's drinking was apparently not a focus of the investigation. But his classmates are still coming forward. For instance, there's his roommate, James Roach, who told CNN last night that Kavanaugh was frequently drunk and he'd come home incoherent and stumbling.
When Brett started saying things about his drinking and his use of certain words, sexually oriented words, you know, I knew he was lying because he was my roommate. And what struck me and made me more interested in speaking out about it is not only did I know that he wasn't telling, you know, the truth, I knew that he knew that he wasn't telling the truth.
And Roach said he was never contacted by the FBI. And then there's the high school friend of Kavanaugh's, Missy Bigelow Carr, who defended Kavanaugh on Morning Edition.
You know, back in those days, there was certainly drinking of beer. That's when you're doing these kind of things and stuff that you have to take. It was an incident in high school. It's kind of hard to believe that at this level of our federal government, that's what we're looking at to try and disqualify somebody from this position.
Well, to Mac, of course, those who are critical of Kavanaugh are saying it's just not one incident. It is a broad culture of drinking and one that he lied about. What is your sense? That's what they are saying, that he lied about it in the hearings. You are under oath and you can't. What is the sense of how that might impact how senators make up their minds in this vote tomorrow? Or will they stick with the he said, she said of the accusation of Professor Ford?
Well, I think the focus of these key senators has been and continues to be these allegations of sexual abuse that have been levied by Professor Ford and Ramirez, rather than on whether Kavanaugh has any issues with drinking. Although Democrats have pounced on what appears to be inconsistencies in this testimony about drinking, it hasn't been the focus or the stated focus of these key kind of moderate senators. The reason for this investigation and this delay in the Kavanaugh confirmation process is these accusations of sexual abuse.
Yeah. Tim Mack, just in the few seconds we have, what's your sense of how this has played out politically? Of course, human lives, you know, lives were involved, most important. But Republicans are claiming that this has actually energized their base, that going into the midterms, that more Republican women, for instance, are saying that they are going to vote based on this in the midterms.
Well, it's interesting, and it really depends on how this plays out between now and Election Day, of course. But NPR has a poll out this week that shows that the enthusiasm gap between Republicans and Democrats, that is, whether they want to turn out on Election Day, has narrowed almost to the point that it doesn't exist. And that's largely due to this Kavanaugh issue.
And the Republicans saying that they are more ginned up. Tim Mack, politics for NPR reporter, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Well, as we continue to follow that story, let's check in on that New York Times report from this week detailing decades of tax dodges by the Trump family. Joining us now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And this is a very long story in the Times, I think 8 pages in print. What did we learn from it?
Well, I think what we learn in some ways is the explosion of the president's self-created image of the idea of a self-created billionaire and mogul, the extent to which, you know, he used to say he relied on a single loan that he had to pay back of $1 million with interest to his father, the real estate developer Fred Trump. It now appears that Fred Trump actually shifted was able to shift wealth on the order of, I think, $413 million that the Times was able to document from his assets to Donald Trump over the years and really backstop Trump in a lot of ways. You know, one small detail to give you an instance, Donald Trump was officially his father's landlord at the age of 3 and starting to receive revenue. You know, from the very earliest years, his father was finding ways to skirt tax laws, state laws, and to convey income without much penalty at all to his kids.
What launched the New York Times reporting on this? Why did they decide to invest such money into this story?
You know, I think it was two things. They were able to obtain through the mail, if you recall, in a story that brought both a lot of interest and some criticism, I guess three pages of a Trump tax document from a couple of decades ago showing that he had possibly lost nearly $1 billion. Then David K. Johnson, the tax reporter who used to work for the Times, obtained some tax documents in 2005 showing he had profited $150 million. And they're saying, what happened in the decade between that time that made him swing from $1 billion loss to $150 million. Remember, one of the key facts about Donald Trump is he has not released his tax documents over the years in ways in which presidential nominees of both parties have done for over 40 years. And so the Times said, let's try to solve that. And it was able to go back and find a number of ways in which, what they say were essentially tax dodges of questionable legality, including through essentially a shell company called the All County Building Supply and Maintenance, which Fred Trump would buy his equipment from but allow the kids to charge him a huge markup for the equipment.
Now, the White House has dismissed this report but hasn't denied any of its claims. President Trump called it a hit piece on Twitter. Where does this go from here?
Well, you've seen some interesting action. The New York State Department of Taxation has said that it's going to review a number of the allegations and claims made in this article. One of the things that makes it so impressive is they include links to all kinds of original documentation so that readers can evaluate for themselves, you know, the basis on which they're making these reporting. And you know, we'll see whether or not this becomes an issue as Democrats look to find ways to take advantage of the unpopularity of the president's tax issue. You could imagine that coming back into play as well. But this is a huge blockbuster of a story that takes a lot of time to absorb and to understand. And I think, you know, one real question will be whether or not Democrats take over the House of Representatives and seek to use this as a hammer against the president, try to force the release of his tax documents.
Do you expect other news organizations will put this kind of energy and effort into stories like this, given the reaction that the New York Times has gotten?
Well, and we don't know that they're not. You know, this was something that, according to the Times, has taken effectively 18 months and that they had well over 1,000 pages of documents to review to make this happen. Several top reporters spent a lot of time on this, as well as editors and other researchers and others on it. It's an incredible devotion of resources. But yes, one has to hope that we're looking at things. Part of the reason the Times is doing this is, as I said, those documents weren't released. And so it's a kind of accountability being performed. It's also the kinds of reporting one wished had been able to be done during the election season. Voters are interested in this stuff. The question is whether this still lingers in 2020. A very interesting insight into our president and the mythology he wrapped himself in as he ran for office.
David Folkenflik of NPR, thank you.
You bet.
Stormy Daniels needs very little introduction. Her real name is Stephanie Clifford. She's a porn star who claims to have had an affair with President Trump more than 10 years ago. Trump denies that, but did authorize a payment of $130,000 to her to stay quiet about it just a month before the election in 2016. Trump's former fixer, Michael Cohen, pleaded guilty to violating campaign finance law by making that payment. Well, Stormy Daniels has a book out this week called Full Disclosure. She joined me from Beverly Hills to talk about it. It is a memoir about more than the night she says she slept with Trump.
Everybody wanted me to write a tell-all. And I was like, I really don't want to do that because, you know, that doesn't define me. Of course, everybody knows that, you know, about that epic, you know, 90 seconds and back in 2006 with Trump. And I was like, I just don't want to write a tell-all because it would be a very, very short book. But then, you know, I really didn't have an outlet to tell my side of the story. Obviously, I went on 60 Minutes and hoped to do that. And the interview was over 3 hours, but once it was edited down, it was only 14 minutes. And some of the really key things that I wanted to express got cut out. Everybody knows what happened, but nobody really knew how or why. So
you feel like you people haven't gotten the full picture of who you are.
Correct. And like I said, how things transpired and why they happened the way they did and the way things unfolded. So I just rushed the book and it was just my way of having complete control. Although, you know, I'm still sure that people are just going to jump straight to chapter three and not read the rest of it anyway.
Well, and you make a joke about that in the book. But let's start with what you talk about at the beginning. You grew up in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. You describe a rough childhood. Your mother would leave you alone for days without food. You say you were repeatedly raped at the age of 9, and you were called a liar when you tried to report that sexual abuse to a guidance counselor. What do you want people to know about you and your life that you don't think that they do already know?
Basically what I just said, that I don't want to be defined by one single evening with someone that I met and just thought it was going to be a crazy night with a goofy TV star. Obviously, I had no inclination, as did anyone else, that he was going to be a politician. You know, I just started the book with the background because I kind of wanted everyone to get a feeling for where I came from. But I think that, like, the most important thing that I wanted to get across is that I was established in my industry as a writer and director and a feature dancer. I had this completely different life, although in its own right, very extraordinary. And so I just wanted people to know that there's a lot more to me than just that night.
What made you decide to finally come out and say, this is what happened?
I was fine with saying nothing at all. If I wasn't, I would have never signed a non-disclosure. I'm not stupid. And if I was going to do that, I would have asked for a lot more than $130,000. Once again, I'm not stupid. I just wanted it to go away. I didn't want it to affect my family or my young child. And I had a pretty successful career. I'd moved behind the camera and was starting to be really known and respected as a director. I directed some mainstream things, some music videos, lived in a small town in Texas, was very happy with, you know, I'm doing air quotes, normal friends. So this is the last thing that I wanted to come out. But then somehow it got leaked and Michael Cohen started running his mouth. And then they wanted me to sign additional statements that were completely false. I was fine with saying nothing, but I didn't want to lie. In the meantime, the story was exploding everywhere and people were attacking me left and right and calling me names. And I just wanted to set the record straight. And I just wanted to be able to tell my side of the story so people would understand where I was coming from. And at the same time, all these other women were coming forward. And I just felt one day that it was the right thing to do. So I did it.
What do you want to happen to Michael Cohen?
I think we're all about to find out on, what is it, December 12th? He was the kind of the orchestrator of this and the one who, most importantly, and if you read the book, you'll understand what I'm saying, he's the one that blew it. You know, I was totally fine with saying nothing at all. I was actually thrilled. And then he's the one that started yapping. He broke the non-disclosure way before I did. And then when he realized he'd messed up, he just continued to do so. I think he's going to get what he deserves. But on the other side of that, I also am starting to have a little bit of admiration and respect that he did finally come clean and admit. The moment that I got the call, I was actually overseas in Europe, when I got the call that he admitted that I was telling the truth, was a huge moment for me, because I'm used to being called all kinds of names. I have a pretty thick skin being in the adult entertainment business, you know. Mm-hmm. But being called a liar was really hard, because I knew I was telling the truth.
Well, and you make clear in this book that you were worried for your safety all along, still are.
Right. That was my other reason for signing the non-disclosure, which we all know was kind of a crappy deal, was because there would be a record. And so I figured nothing could really happen to me, because there were people who knew about this non-disclosure. Now, my fear lies mostly with just sort of crazy fans, not, you know, directly related to the government or anything like that.
Mm. But you've got bodyguards now.
I do. I have two. They're awesome.
But what is that like? I mean, to now be in a situation where you've got to have bodyguards all the time because of coming forward with your story.
It was very overwhelming at first. You know, I was used to being able to travel alone. I was used to being able to go to the bathroom alone. Mm-hmm. That's gone. But over the last several months, you know, I've adapted and I've gotten used to it and we've become friends, and it's just the way that it is.
You describe in this book when you first met President Trump in Lake Tahoe back in July of 2006, and you say your first impression of him was that he was run-of-the-mill insecure, which I find happens a lot with people with money that they didn't earn themselves. They harbor this inner self-esteem problem that they try to mask by overcompensating. As you've been thinking back about that moment, and as you've seen him, as we all have over the last couple of years, has it shaped the way that you perceived him at the beginning at all?
No, not much. I still stand by that feeling. You know, ask anyone. I'm not personally a dominatrix, but I have a lot of friends in the adult business that's what they do, or that's part of their job. And they will tell you that their biggest paying and most unusual clients are CEOs and presidents of companies and people in high power. And then the other thing about that is that people who grow up very privileged and spoiled, for lack of a better word, lack social skills because no one's ever told them no. And I think that was pretty obvious and still holds true today.
How would you describe him today?
I don't know. I would have to. I mean, I haven't talked to him in 12 years. I think that he is a different person. At least the night I hung out with him, he could make complete sentences.
There's a report in the Wall Street Journal this week that alleges that Trump personally directed an effort earlier this year to stop you from publicly describing your alleged affair with him. How do you respond to that?
I found out about that the same time you did. I think it was yesterday, just reading news online. It's the first time I've heard of that, honestly. And it doesn't surprise me that it happened. It just surprises me that I'm just now finding out about it.
That actually brings me to another question, which is how much do you have to pay attention to the news now? Are you reading the news a lot more than you used to?
Actually, the exact opposite. For
really?
Months, for like the first couple of months, I was obsessed and was reading everything. And I can't tell you the last time I actually had a TV on in my hotel room. It just adds unnecessary stress. And it's the same thing over and over and over.
So you're not following politics closely?
Politics, yes, but I'm not reading the news and the news stories, and especially staying away from anything about me.
Well, you're coming out with this book just a month before the midterm elections. Do you want this to influence the way that people vote?
That was not my intention at all. That was literally, how fast can it get done? How fast can it get printed? How fast can this happen? It was not a strategy, at least not on my part. Maybe the publisher is smarter than I thought, but I don't think so. I don't think it was actually part of a master plan.
What do you want to happen in the midterm elections? Or do you have a view on that?
You know, I do. I think that it's going to be very interesting. Like I said, I've watched everything turn. I don't want to jinx anything, so I'm just going to wait and see.
Okay. I want to ask you about one more thing that's in the news right now, which is that President Trump has been talking at these rallies about Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford and her testimony. And he just, at a campaign rally, mocked Christine Blasey Ford. Here he is.
I had one beer, right? I had one beer. Well, do you think it was? Nope, it was one beer. Oh, good. How did you get home? I don't remember. How'd you get there? I don't remember. Where is the place? I don't remember. How many years ago was it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
Stormy Daniels, what do you think when you hear that?
That he sounds like a petulant child. You know, that's what he does. He attacks people and tears down their character and whatever. And I'm not defending or, you know, negating what was said or anything like that. It's not my place, nor do I have any inside knowledge, so I would rather not comment. But I do know that he lashes out, and that's not very becoming of a leader.
What is the one thing you're hoping people take away from reading this book?
That things aren't always what they seem, and there's more than one side to every story. And I'm not a liar, and I didn't blackmail anyone. And you know, that I am human, and maybe it will open their eyes to other girls in the adult business that we do have a voice. And I hope that, most importantly, the number one thing that I want to take away from this is that it inspires other people who need to speak up for themselves to do so.
That's Stormy Daniels, whose book is called Full Disclosure. It is out this week. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Judge Brett Kavanaugh's often combative testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee initially prompted speculation that it would push women to vote this November for Democrats. Turns out the opposite may be happening. According to a new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll, Republican women are now more likely than Democratic women to describe the upcoming midterm elections as very important. Chaz Sisk from member station WPLN in Nashville found that women who support the president are the ones digging in their heels.
Retired great-grandmother Clara Henderson describes herself as a lifelong Democrat. She says she voted for President Barack Obama twice. And as she watched the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing last week, her heart went out to Christine Blasey Ford.
She looked scared to me, and she looked betrayed to me. I really feel bad for her to have to be on national television in front of millions of people to share that experience that's so personal, although I do feel like she should have been heard.
But Henderson is also a backer of President Trump, and sympathy toward Ford did not outweigh the 69-year-old woman's support for Judge Brett Kavanaugh.
I feel like that he's being used as a scapegoat for everybody, and his good name and his good character is going to be forever tarnished.
Henderson says she's wary. She fears a culture in Washington, on college campuses, and in the media that's, in her words, getting out of control. Other interviews in a park in Cookeville, a small city just over an hour's drive east of Nashville, turn up more women who agree. Edith Mann, also a grandmother, says there's no proof that Kavanaugh did anything wrong. So it's a he said, she said situation, and one that's playing out decades too late.
If everybody was held responsible for what they done in their teenage years, in their college years, how many of them would be in his seat today?
That viewpoint can also be found in Nashville, which Trump lost by a nearly 2-to-1 margin in 2016. Linda Anderson was walking her poodles in 12 South, a trendy neighborhood crammed full of coffee shops, fashion boutiques, and, yes, several yoga studios. Anderson recently moved to this area from Los Angeles, which she joked was too liberal for her.
Oh, I hope he will be confirmed. Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Why so?
Why? Because I believe him, like what he said.
If there is a trend to be divined, it's that younger women seem more likely to come down against Kavanaugh's appointment. Katie DeLorme is a professional photographer visiting Nashville from Seattle. She's 34 and describes herself as politically independent, and she puts little trust in Kavanaugh.
Even more so after watching his testimony and how angry he is, I just believe his reaction was a little over the top.
The hearing has come up in Tennessee's crucial Senate race. Republican Marsha Blackburn, a member of Congress vying to be the state's first woman elected to the Senate, has been ardently pro-Kavanaugh. Her Democratic opponent, former Tennessee Governor Phil Bredesen, has urged the Senate to go slowly on the nomination. Jessica Jarrett, a supervisor at a local teacher's college, doubts the Kavanaugh issue will change many minds.
If anything, I hope that it drives people to the polls, but I don't think it'll affect it one way or the other.
Why not?
Because I think the majority of people are already set in their ways.
And with midterm elections that could shift the balance of power in Congress coming soon, the side that's able to turn out voters angry about the Kavanaugh hearing may have an advantage. For Here and Now, I'm Chaz Sisk in Nashville.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Joining us today, the original DJ from the Here and Now DJ Sessions, Travis Holcomb at KCRW in Santa Monica. Hi, Travis.
Hello, Jeremy. Great to be back.
You too. How have you been? It's been so long since we've talked to you.
I know. Ever since the last time we've spoken, or at least since the last time I've been to this NPR studio, they've completely redone it.
Oh,
it's really
wow.
Nice so over it's, here.
Okay, but the music will still be incredible because it's coming from you. This
of
is
course.
The first one, Polo and Pan, two French DJs. This is their song, Aqualand. So they're saying there, suivez-moi sous les océans, which is follow me under the ocean. Tell us about this one.
You know, this album Caravelle by Polo and Pan, it came out last year, but then it got re-released this year in the States with five additional tracks, and that's when it sort of came onto my radar. It's got a very tropical kind of feel throughout the album. And I know we're in the fall now, but it's been a while since I spoke to you, so I just wanted to catch everybody
up
on
classic.
This
right.
is the sound of the summer.
Right. Okay.
You can still use it next summer too. But when I'm screening albums to looking for stuff to play on my show, if I can find 3 or 4 songs on an album, I'm really happy, and I consider that to be a good album. This Caravelle album, though, has 17 tracks, and I think I've played something like 14 of them on my show already. So basically, like, every track on this album is great, and that is like an unheard ratio for my show to be into that many of the songs. But there's so many different looks. I mean, they have like some songs inspired by Brazilian samba. There's some daytime disco. There's some club-ready house cuts, some ambient songs. They kind of run the whole gamut.
And what would you say is the genre overall?
I would say sort of like tropical electronic. I mean, I would say, you know, they've definitely got an ear for pop, But it definitely is more electronic driven. And if I were to draw any comparisons between other bands, I would say it's sort of like Disclosure meets Poolside.
Oh, I like that. That's great. We had Poolside on the show, actually. They're great.
Yeah.
Let's listen to the next one you brought us. This is the Swedish group Viagra Boys. This is called Sports.
Surfboard, ping pong, rugby ball, wiener doll.
Okay, so tell us what's going on here.
You know what? I am not completely clear on what's going on, okay. But I've seen a couple different interpretations of this particular song, and some people, they're saying it's a commentary on male hypermasculinity.
Hmm.
When I first heard it, I just thought it was a really goofy, fun track. And it's one of those songs, like, it reminds me when I was a little kid, I wasn't allowed to watch Miami Vice before I went to sleep because it would get me way too fired up before bed. And this song sort of has the same effect on me every time I hear it.
And obviously funny. Would you say it's, like, a good listen to? Do you like to listen to it?
The song is an unbelievably fun listen, yes. I mean, like, it's after you get through the hook the first time, you'll be chanting the hook on your own the second time it comes around and every other time. As the song moves on, he becomes the lead singer, Sebastian Murphy, becomes more and more unhinged until at the end, he's basically just a blobby puddle.
Well, people can go on our website and listen to the entire thing at Here and Now.
I really hope they do.
OK, the next one is from Ireland. This is Maverick Sabre, who just released this new song, Drifting. Here it is.
I'm listening in the car with the cops in the rear.
I like that a lot. A beautiful voice.
Absolutely. I mean, it's such an unorthodox delivery, too, and I think that's the first thing that really caught my attention with this song. The beat is really simple, really funky, but more than that, it's just sort of the way he sounds on it. It's just kind of otherworldly.
Who is Maverick Sabre?
He's an Irish R&B singer. I guess he's been releasing records since 2011. I know a lot of people have been fans with him for a while. I just sort of caught on to him with this song, Drifting. But he's also on the label of Georgia Smith, who is sort of an up-and-coming R&B singer from the UK. And he's appeared on one of Georgia Smith's EPs, the Project 11 EP. And I think that's where a lot of people maybe heard Maverick Sabre for the first time.
Okay, the next one that you brought us is Wolverine. This is from Diana Gordon. What should we know about this one?
Diana Gordon just released her first EP as a solo artist, but she's been around the music industry for a while, and she's written for Mary J. Blige, and she had 3 songs on Beyoncé's Lemonade album, including Sorry, Daddy Lessons, and Don't Hurt Yourself.
Hmm.
And she had a previous career as an EDM singer under the name Winter Gordon, but I feel like this is Diana Gordon kind of doing her own thing. Sort of a reinvention of Diana Gordon, I guess.
And but clearly multi-talented person.
Yeah, I mean, she definitely knows how to write songs, and she can sing them, too. I mean, sometimes when a singer sings, you can sort of feel their heart and soul and sweat of experience mm-hmm. in their voice. And to me, this is one of those instances. She's just sort of recalling her upbringing and sort of, you know, it's also very aspirational at the same time.
The last one that you have brought us is Albatross. This is from Westerman.
We
could spend the day here, waste it all on some new friend. You better catch the light. I've come connected. If you are rejected, dead laying albatross passing me by.
What should we know about this one?
So Albatross is the first single from Westerman's forthcoming ARC EP, and it is a solo artist named Will Westerman. So he performs under his surname, and he's been kind of just releasing tracks for the past year or so. I think he's put out two EPs, and this is the first single from the forthcoming EP. And he's had a long-standing partnership with the producer Bouillon, who's a really talented artist in his own right. I mean, we heard from Polo and Pan earlier. This feels very autumnal to me. Westerman's got, there's a beautiful sense of loneliness and wistfulness in his voice that it just feels very ethereal and almost ghostly.
It's funny that you brought us from summer to fall, and yet where you are in Southern California, there really isn't that much of a difference between
the two. There's generally not, but I will say this recently we've gotten the first taste of what fall in Los Angeles kind of feels like. It's below 80 degrees.
Below 80, and a little bit of rain.
A little bit of rain, yeah. Right.
Well, there you go. Now you know what it's like to live on the East Coast. Travis Holcomb, DJ at KCRW, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And you can hear more. Go to our Spotify playlist. That's NPR Here and Now on Spotify. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
One of the world's biggest soccer stars, Cristiano Ronaldo, although you don't usually need the first name, won't play for Portugal's national team in a pair of upcoming matches as he fights rape allegations in the U.S. A woman claims Ronaldo assaulted her in Las Vegas in 2009. He's denied it. Mike Pesca is Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. And, Mike, there is a lot of this in the ether. You know, sometimes the show feels like a police blotter, but this is huge, right, in sports?
Yes. He's a $400 million man. That is his worth. He is the best, one of the two or three best soccer players in the world, which is to say the most popular sport. And in terms of marketing, because of his sex appeal, because of his charisma, he earns more endorsement dollars than anyone else. So yeah. This is a charge, and it seems like a very serious charge against just an absolute icon.
Well, and he denies it, but what more is known about the charge?
Okay, so it goes back to 2009, and the accuser in this case claims that she met Ronaldo with friends one night in Las Vegas nightclub Rain. They went up to his room. Friends of theirs went into a hot tub. He gave her something to change into, and when they were changing, he forcibly sodomized her. Then she goes on to claim that he and his team sort of extracted she got him to pay $375,000. She negotiated a payment so that charges would not be brought. And that payment is at the center of her lawsuit. Her lawsuit, like you said, is 9 years old. Now, Las Vegas recently changed its laws to extend the statute of limitations on rape to 20 years. And the Las Vegas police have said they've reopened the case, not filed charges, but reopened the case. But a lot of this depends on whether the agreement would be voided by a court, and she and her new counsel are arguing there are several reasons that a court should void that agreement, that payment for $375,000.
Oh, boy. What are the chances that he will be in a court in the U.S.?
Well, there are extradition treaties between European countries and the United States, but that is getting far ahead of ourselves. Mm-hmm. Like I said, who's to say whether actual criminal charges will be brought? He can avoid coming to the United States while playing friendly matches. He could live his life quite well, never setting foot in the United States again. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, this case could be dismissed by the courts who will never weigh in whether there was or wasn't an assault. They could just stop at whether this was or wasn't a legitimate agreement. Now, the woman says it wasn't legitimate. She had inadequate counsel. She also says she was so traumatized at the time that she was misled by this fairly inexperienced, although she said a few years of experience, counsel. The courts could stop there, or the courts could say there's enough credibility to some reasons why this should be voided. There's also a question of if Ronaldo did or didn't read a letter from her, that there seems to be some conflicting story about if he did, and if that's part of the agreement, that he needs to have read this letter, and he denies reading the letter. Maybe that alone can, yeah. I've seen some legal experts say, reopen this case, as it were.
Boy, so we will keep an eye on that, because as you say, it's hugely important in this huge sport. But mm-hmm. we want to pivot here and turn to the baseball playoffs, because the Colorado Rockies are playing the Brewers in Milwaukee, the Atlanta Braves taking on the Dodgers in Los Angeles. These are the National League Division Series matches, the rookies and Brewers, and then the Dodgers lost to the Houston Astros in the World Series last year. You know, so they're good. Not a surprise they made it again. The Braves maybe weren't expected to be here. Just take on the National League Series.
Yeah, so the Dodgers played in a one-game playoff, and this earned them the right to avoid the wild card, and so they're division winners. They've underperformed all year and should be the class of the National League, but it's baseball. The sport has a lot of vagaries, but I would say they are the favorite, and the Rockies are riding high on having won the wild card game. The Milwaukee Brewers, like you said, are a surprise. I don't know. I would say that what we've been saying all year is that the Dodgers are the team that looms in the National League, but they haven't been great. They really haven't been great this year.
Over in the American League, Cleveland plays the Astros. The New York Yankees take on the Boston Red Sox. Huh. That's the first time the two have played each other since what year was that? 2004.
What happened then?
I don't know. Maybe
it's a comeback.
The Yankees blew a 3-0 lead over the Sox, and Boston
went
on the
win. It was quite a comeback, yes.
Boston had its first World Series title in 86 years. So we'll take a look there. Cleveland, Astros, New York Yankees, Red Sox.
Okay, these are all excellent teams. The Yankees won the wild card game against the A's, and they really crushed the A's last night. It is kind of odd that for the whole year, there was a week or two where it seemed like maybe the Yankees could possibly climb in a combination, could have been a contender against the Red Sox. They never were. So here we have baseball, where the Red Sox have just outclassed the Yankees, or just been, 10 games better than them all year. Mm. And their only advantage right now is a one-game home field advantage, which doesn't really matter in the playoffs. And I would say so much of the Red Sox chances rely on their ace hurler, Chris Sale, who has been injured.
Right.
Now, he came back from injury. He's striking a lot of guys out, but he seems to have lost a few miles on his fastball. So who knows?
Who really knows?
I know this. The Red Sox are not afraid of the Yankees at all, and I think the Astros aren't looking past the Indians, but that should be the matchup to watch in the American League.
We're not afraid of no Yankees. Mike Pesca here, No Sports Analyst. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Here now, a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.